We can talk among ourselves in 140 characters. Some people are better than that than others. Some people should probably do less of it. But the bottom line is these technologies also can be used to undermine our democracy and put our nation at risk.
That's Senator Lindsey Graham talking about social media at a congressional hearing on Russian interference last week. It's got us thinking about information, misinformation, and how to be more media literate. Plus, Illinois lawmakers appointed a new legislative investigative general over the weekend, appointing former U.S. Assistant Attorney Julie Porter to the post during a private meeting on Saturday afternoon. But first, reporting domestic violence to the police is hard enough, but it can be even more stressful for immigrants who are living in the U.S. illegally. We'll talk to advocates about a visa program that tries to make it easier to come forward. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every year, 10 million people in the United States are abused by an intimate partner, and it can be doubly hard for victims of domestic violence who don't have the legal authorization to be living in the U.S., especially when it comes to reporting this crime to local police. That's why Congress created a special visa in 2000 to protect victims of domestic violence who also happen to be immigrants living in the U.S. illegally. Those who help police investigate their domestic violence cases are eligible for what are called U visas. About 10,000 people receive these visas every year nationwide. But advocates here in Illinois worry that it's much harder to get this visa depending on where you live. And we're going to talk about that in a few minutes with the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence's Director of Policy. But first, I'm joined by Raina Wences. She's a community organizer with the West Suburban Action Project. Raina, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning, Raina. I know this morning you were talking with one of our producers about one of the women that you've helped. Her name is Sylvia Perez, and she lives in Bloomington. She wasn't able to come on the show, but I know you've been in contact with her through the West Suburban Action Project. I wonder if you can share a little bit of her story with us.
Yes, of course. So Sylvia is has been a member of PASO for a couple of years now, of the West Suburban Action Project. We actually, the organization, met her through a detention case of her husband. It seems, her husband was detained on his way to work back in 2011. Sylvia was afraid of being left alone if, you know, her husband was to be deported, and so she started reaching out to many community organizations in the suburbs and in Chicago, and ended up meeting the National Immigrant Justice Center, who supported her through this detention case of her husband. Through the legal assessment that she was able to acquire via the National Immigrant Justice Center, she actually ended up sharing that she had been a victim of domestic violence from a previous partner that she had. She shares that this is something that she had not shared with anyone. This is something that happened to her in 2001, and she had kept that even from her husband, who at the time was in deportation proceedings, because of the shame of having to share something like that. She shared with me that, you know, she said no one is ever proud of being a victim of violence, and so that's why she kept it inside until, through the legal assessment that she was getting from the National Immigrant Justice Center, she was able to share this fact with an attorney. And upon more legal assessment and interviewing, it turned out that, yes, indeed, Sylvia had been a victim of domestic violence. She survived. She had to flee her home and leave her children behind because her life was in danger. And she actually was really afraid of telling the police about this incident, but because her life was in such grave danger, she actually ended up reaching to the police and did a police report. Mm-hmm. And so all of this, all of these facts came to light in 2011 when she was, you know, fighting for to stop the deportation of her husband. And so she ended up being eligible for the U visa. She shared with me that upon realizing that she was eligible to apply for the U visa, she started fearing again. She had some trauma, and she was afraid that the police were not going to cooperate with her and sign the certification form because she had heard that that other people in her community had also experienced something similar. So, that's basically her story.
When you said she was afraid, she said she was worried because she'd heard of other people who had tried to get this visa and it hadn't worked. Is that what she was worried about?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And she actually had to wait 2 months and a lot of back and forth before she was able to get a U certification form signed by the Bloomington Police Department.
And so is that how it works with these certification forms? The police department certifies this?
Yes. So the U visa certification is a form that has to be certified by the agency investigating the crime. And basically it's saying, right, what the details of what happened and if the person cooperated in the investigation of said crime. And so for Sylvia, she had cooperated indeed in 2001. There was proof. She had a police report. She had been doing interviews. There was a paper trail per se attesting to her cooperation in the investigation of the things that happened to her.
Raina, you're a community organizer in Chicago's West Suburbs. You're based in Melrose Park. I wonder how often you hear stories of women like Sylvia who have unfortunately been through situations that involve domestic violence.
Yes, actually, I, as part of the West Suburban Action Project, we have a legal clinic where we see undocumented immigrants that come to seek that service. And many of the times, many of them are victims of crimes. And, you know, what I find really interesting is just the way that each agency acts upon these responding to these certification forms. In instances where people are victims of crimes in the city of Chicago, there is sometimes a waiting list, and people will wait for months. I think they've gotten better, but the further away we get from the metropolitan area, the harder it is for individuals like Sylvia to get the certification form signed, because in many of the cases, either the law enforcement agency that is investigating the crime does not have the proper information about what this U certification means, and other times it's actually because they don't know, they don't want to sign it. There's been some law enforcement agencies that have told us that they think that, you know, that signing a certification form is actually petitioning for somebody to get papers, and that's actually not the truth. The truth is that this certification form just confirms that the person has been a victim of a crime, that survived and that cooperated in the investigation, right? And so it is not up to the law enforcement agency to decide whether the person is going to get their papers or not or get the U visa approved. It's actually, that's the job of the immigration, USCIS, the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency. And so in the case of Sylvia, she waited, like I mentioned, almost 2 months to get this certification form signed. In the meantime, she was still struggling, knowing that her husband was in detention. And so after 2 months, the U certification form was signed, and she was able to then go through the whole process of applying for the U visa, which took about a year and a half for her to receive the U visa. And now, years later, almost 4 years later, she is now a resident of the United States.
Okay. That's Raina Wences, who's been telling us about the case of Sylvia Perez in Bloomington. Raina's based out in the Chicago suburbs. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Carrie Boyd is on the line from Springfield, where she's the director of policy for the Illinois Coalition for Domestic Violence. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Good morning. As you are hearing Raina sharing the story of Sylvia, but also just sort of giving us a sense of what her agency has worked with, Raina said something that I think wanted to ask you about, was just about the fact that maybe in the city of Chicago, this is something where the police department in Chicago is more familiar with the U visa than perhaps other municipalities and other police departments across the state. Have you all found that that's the case, that even though this is the law and that this was law that passed 17 years ago, perhaps there are other law enforcement across the state that are not as familiar with this?
Hi. Well, yes, I think there is a difference in familiarity based on geography and jurisdiction. I also find that talking with folks throughout the state, that there is just a lack of consistency between those jurisdictions. And so there may be familiarity in the more populated areas. However, there is no procedure in place that is uniform across our state. And so, as Raina described, a lot of the survivors of domestic violence and trafficking often don't know what they're going to get when they walk into a police department or work with an investigator in terms of a response. And so Senate Bill 32, really what it does is it clarifies some of the state procedures that would be needed when designating certification processes in law enforcement agencies. It's really about clarification so that we have a consistent process across our state and so that everyone is served in the same fashion.
So that's Carrie Boyd with the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence talking to us about the VOICES Act, Senate Bill 32. So, Carrie, this was originally part of the TRUST Act, correct? That was legislation that was passed earlier this year that really sets a standard that hasn't been set in any other state for how law enforcement should be dealing with people who are here illegally. This was spun off from that, correct?
Yes, this provision regarding UNT visas was part of the initial TRUST Act, and after meeting with allies and law enforcement and various parts of the legislators' offices, we just decided that this needed to be separate. We had some more work to do, not that it wasn't as important or as vital to our survivors, but we just needed to rehone the language and make it workable for everyone. And I feel that a lot of progress has been made in the last few weeks. In that vein, we've been working closely with law enforcement officials, members of the House and Senate, and trying to make the language of the bill palatable for everyone involved.
And has there been pushback from law enforcement? Raina said that some law enforcement agencies feel like this is somehow certifying immigration status, which is, of course, something that's out of their purview. Have you heard that from other law enforcement agencies?
Yes, I have heard from our programs. So ICADV, we represent 50-plus domestic violence agencies across the state, and our programs provide feedback to us. And what we consistently hear is that there are concerns about certification being the same as granting citizenship or other rights. We also hear concerns about folks don't want to certify right away or even within 2 or 3 months, that they feel some investigations are ongoing, and making the certification quickly could lead to hampering of that investigation. But we have worked really closely with law enforcement in the last few weeks. I feel confident that we're going to get to where we have an agreed bill, or at least a bill where everyone can be neutral. And I certainly want to say that I've never felt that the position of law enforcement is that they're anti-survivors or they don't want to help folks who have been experiencing violence. It's more about arriving at a consensus about the proper protocols. And so I think that there have just been so many folks at the table pushing this language, making it work, that I really think we're going to get there in the next few days.
Right. So this passed the Senate 49-6. I'm not sure what the timing is for the House taking this up. Before we get to that, I just wonder, we just have a few minutes left here. Carrie, do you sense a greater need of urgency for this bill because of the new Trump administration and what's happening out of Washington in terms of deportation and immigration?
Well, I certainly can say that I feel this bill and what it represents is emblematic of many of our programs and their constituents, the victims that they serve. It's a beacon of hope for those folks who have been subject to violence. And I do think that there is an increased concern given some political administrative challenges that are being faced. I do think that time is of the essence. Any time we're confronted with policies that could help survivors of violence. And so I really encourage every legislator to get behind this bill and help make it law here during veto session.
Raina, what about you? Do you feel like this bill is even more important now in Illinois because of the Trump administration?
Yes, I believe that people, well, you know, in cases like Sylvia, this happened to her before the Trump administration. And so I believe that it was important a few years ago. It continues to be important more now, given that the immigrant community and other communities are under attack from the federal administration.
Carrie, just a quick question for you. Are you confident that this is going to pass the House and get signed by the governor?
Well, we certainly hope so. We're working hard in veto session to get it through. Governor Rauner, as you know, was a supporter of the Trust Act in the end, and he did sign the bill. I think that it's a very important piece of legislation, and it continues to protect survivors of violence in a way that they deserve. And so I truly hope that we can get this passed in the House and on to the governor for his signature soon.
Carrie Boyd is the Director of Policy at the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence. I want to thank her, along with Raina Wences, who's a community organizer with the West Suburban Action Project in Melrose Park. Ladies, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we'll be keeping an eye on that Voices Act, that Senate Bill 32, as that happens in veto session. Later in the hour, we're going to be getting more of a preview of what will be happening as lawmakers are heading back to Springfield. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, Facebook, Twitter, and Google were grilled on Capitol Hill for potentially enabling Russian interference in the 2016 election. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham and his opening statements from those hearings.
Not only do we use it, not only did the president use it, millions of Americans use your technology. We can share aspects of our lives with those who mean the most to us. And we can talk among ourselves in 140 characters. Some people are better than that than others. Some people should probably do less of it. But the bottom line is these technologies also can be used to undermine our democracy and put our nation at risk.
That's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina talking to lawyers from Google, Twitter, and Facebook who were called to the Hill to talk about Russian manipulation of information on their platforms. So think about the last time you were on Facebook or Twitter or Google, probably perhaps just within the past 5 minutes. Facebook, for one, just announced a 76% increase in its revenue in the last quarter. It seems regardless of what congressional leaders discover about how information or misinformation is distributed on social media, those platforms are obviously not going away anytime soon. And when it comes to online news, maybe it's about separating the good, bad, and the ugly. We wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about these issues with Nicole Cook. She's a professor at the University of Illinois School of Information Science. Hi, Nicole. She's in our Urbana studios, I should say. Welcome back to The 21st.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. A studio with me here in downtown Chicago is Erica Hobbs. She's the communications director and Chicago program manager for the News Literacy Project. Hi, Erica.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So as these congressional hearings have unfolded, we've really been seeing the idea of misinformation having such a huge impact. And Facebook reported as many as 126 million users may have seen content that, quote, originated from the Russian operation. Nicole, I wonder, I mean, when we think about this, 126 million users and the size of overall Facebook, that's probably not that big. But what does that number say to you?
It says that people are going for what's easy, right? So not only do we enjoy Facebook and other social media platforms for entertainment because they connect us to friends and loved ones, it's just a very centralized place. So we've become accustomed to getting our ideas, our thoughts, and our news, and we're looking less to other sources, newspapers and the radio and television and places that we used to go first for our news.
Nicole, do you think this is a question of controlling information or is it a question of understanding information?
I definitely think it's a little bit of both. But I think for what we're dealing with now, this is really about understanding information and understanding how information is produced and shared and not just taking information at face value. I think that's where we run into trouble with the misinformation and also disinformation.
Erica, I would imagine as someone who works with the News Literacy Project, you'd say a lot of this is also about how we understand information, because I wonder if you think how much of it can we control anymore?
Absolutely. But we do think that students can be in power. So we focus mainly on middle school and high school students. We want to catch them early. And we do absolutely believe that
that it's really about understanding.
Yeah, it's really about understanding. Yeah, because they don't have to be. People are used to being passive consumers of news and media, and it's sort of a changing of habits that they have to do now. So we've tried to empower students.
And so you work particularly with middle school, you said?
Middle and high school.
So, and when we think about this, you think about middle and high school students and how much different their news consumption upbringing has been from our generation, Erica. You and I actually, I was thinking when you and I were at Medill Graduate School together at the same time, that was a different era. So what do you all do now with young people in terms of working with this younger generation of who's grown up in an environment of not just, as Nicole was talking about, broadcast news or sort of established news outlets? Now it's sort of a lot more of social media channels and Snapchat and other information. How do you go about teaching younger people about how to discern this?
Well, one of the things that we learned last year through kind of a groundbreaking report was that digital natives don't know how to apply their critical thinking skills to figure out whether they're reading an ad or whether they're reading something fake or whether they're reading actual news. So what we do is we teach students to think like a journalist. So we ask them to kind of stop and to be critical a little bit, to ask about the who, the what, the why, the where, the when, before they go ahead and take any kind of action, whether they're buying something or sharing information on social media.
Nicole, do you think this is just a problem with digital natives, as Erica is talking about? Or I imagine it's kind of everyone in a sense. Do you think, Nicole?
I think it's everyone. Certainly the digital natives are dealing with a different scenario, right? So they're not used to some of the sources that adults have been used to previously. But I do think it's definitely all ages. And I think, you know, when we're talking about adults and older adults, who, you know, you would think would know better in terms of trying to decipher information, I think this is where emotion and other motivators and other contextual factors really come into play that keep people from believing what they think they should know. They're very responding to emotion and other factors that make them susceptible to fake news.
And when we think about this, Nicole, I wonder, I remember the last conversation you and I had was, I think, right around the election or right after the election, talking about this issue. And now I feel like as more and more information comes out, I feel like every time we learn about this, we just sort of learn about the problem becoming worse, frankly. I don't know if that's in terms of having information out there that's incorrect or deliberately misleading. I wonder, as you've watched this unfold over the past couple of months, what to you strikes a chord in terms of what you're most worried about at this moment?
I'm worried about the sheer volume of information. And I think, you know, to your point, even since our last conversation, there are more and more news producers. There are blogs, there are YouTube vloggers, there are all sorts of people coming to us under the guise of delivering news. And it becomes overwhelming. and it becomes that much more difficult to decipher what's real, what's satire, what's humor, what's fake, and that's being produced for monetary gain. And so it's just really hard to decipher. And I think that's one of the major things that we're concerned with now, is just the sheer volume and trying to weed our way through everything.
And Erica, when you're talking particularly about middle schoolers or high schoolers, I wonder, when you're teaching them all of this, what makes them the most upset as they're learning about this? Are they probably, do you find that with younger people, there is a realization like, hey, there are people out there who are deliberately lying to us, and it's, we need to try to figure this out?
I think upset is a good word to use. I'm not entirely sure. It's more of surprise. So when it's not always easy to connect to students when we talk about something in the news, but when we could talk about maybe something that's more consumer oriented, like a fake McDonald's promotion or something like that, then yes, their eyes kind of open and they say, oh, I kind of get it now. But I'd like to touch on something that our guest said.
That Nicole said.
Yeah. So we know that the biggest group of people on Facebook who talk about fake news and who share fake news are the ages of 45 to 65. And so we are generally, you know, as a field, trying to figure out what can we do to teach these people some new habits.
So let's talk about the term fake news, Erica. How would you, well, at the News Literacy Project, how do you define that?
We are really careful about our definition of fake news, and we are very careful about using it. Sometimes we think about trying not to use it at all because it's sort of lost its meaning, right? But what we decided that when we use it, we typically use it in quotes, and we've decided that it's deliberately made up information that's designed to dupe somebody on purpose.
And so to your point about the fact that the most people who are sharing, let's just go with bad information or wrong information online, is between the ages of 45 to 65. What do you think what should we be doing about this generation of Facebook users and teaching this generation to be better consumers of information?
There's still a lot of research that's out on that, but it looks like what we have to do is to teach people to navigate digital information. It's completely different from sitting in front of a TV and passively accepting news or reading a newspaper. So one of the things that we're finding out that people have to do is to actually read laterally. So they kind of have to click through what they're reading to do a little bit of research to figure out if what they're reading is real or if what they're reading is an ad.
So, Nicole, when we say this, to think like a librarian or a journalist and to click through, as Erica's saying, would you suggest to people then that they're sort of clicking through and doing their own investigations before you read something and share something? How would you suggest people figure out who the source is?
Definitely. And I agree just with you, with what you said in terms of people doing a little manual work, right? I think sometimes it's easy to kind of rely on browser plugins and Facebook saying that they're going to flag fake news. And I think that people need to start just doing, you know, a couple of steps before they share. So thinking about, where have they seen this information? Have they seen it in more than one place? Do they recognize the source and the author of the information? Is the page riddled with ads, or is it from a news organization or a newspaper? So it doesn't have to be anything overly complicated, but just kind of stepping back and saying, let me just make sure about this information before I share it with others.
Nicole, what would you say I'm just curious about what you think about the definition of companies like Twitter and Google and Facebook, because I'm curious how you see them. They certainly don't define themselves as media organizations. Certainly, Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg didn't even show up for the hearings. They sent their lawyers, and the same for Twitter. So I wonder if you think it's important to make a distinction between how we even define these organizations like Facebook and Twitter?
Yes. So I think really what it comes down to is, if they just rebrand themselves without any action, it really won't make a difference. The general public is still going to see them as entertainment, as social media, as a technology company. If they were really going to rename themselves or rebrand themselves as a news organization, they'd have to be much more transparent with explicit guidelines for the information that they allow. They'd need some guidelines for fact-checking, and they need content experts working at these organizations in addition to the coders and the technologists and the folks that they currently have employed. So I think words without actions won't do us any good.
Right. And of course, that's something that Facebook in particular has said they will be doing. Erica, what about you? Do you think that we need to think about, as consumers, the way that we define these organizations? Do you think we should change our own definitions in our head of these organizations?
I don't know that we can change the definition, but I do know that we believe that people need to understand what that struggle is. You know, as these platforms are trying to figure out whether they're broadcasters or just social media platforms, and understand that there is this tension between, you know, the sort of freewheeling world of the internet and the First Amendment and censorship. We don't take a position on that at NLP. What we try to do is just to empower consumers with that information.
Right. But I guess my question is there such a thing as just a social media company anymore?
I don't know. I think that as a society, we're still trying to figure that out.
Right. And I know the News Literacy Project has been actually working a little bit with Facebook to bring about some change. Can you tell us about what you guys are doing with them?
Sure. We have partnered with them for about 10 months now, and they've been fantastic. And one of the first things that we've done with them is create a series of public service announcements that teach older people, like that band that we were talking about, how to figure out what's fake and what's not. And so far, that has been it's gone really well. The reception was really good.
And what are those PSAs? What are those hints? You mentioned something, but sort of, is this kind of along the lines of like lateral, which you were saying in terms of sort of clicking and checking sources?
Yeah, we found one of the ones that was most effective was simple call to action. Think before you share.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Nicole, I wonder, from your perspective, do you think there is such a thing as a social media company anymore? Or do you think it's just where there are just such broader definitions now because they are distributors of news and media?
Yeah, it's so much more complicated now than when all of these platforms emerged. I think certainly they were definitely just social media at the time. And I think that it's just changed that they or nor anyone else have been able to control. So I don't think that they're strictly social media, although I don't know that they're prepared to be a news organization at this point. So I think there's a lot of gray area that still needs to be tackled.
Nicole, I wonder what challenges you think librarians face the most when it comes to information literacy and the quote-unquote fake news.
Mm-hmm. So like I mentioned, just the sheer amount of information is certainly a problem facing librarians. And really, I think part of what we deal with in the profession is really letting people know and getting people to understand that we can help them with this. Librarians are doing lots of classes and workshops, and we've always really taught classes and dealt with the public trying to enhance their critical thinking skills. So it's just really kind of matching the message with the audience and really trying to explain to our users the complexity, as Erica mentioned, about everything that is entailed with this fake news moniker in the current phenomenon.
Right. And lots of new challenges for you all as librarians. Can I just ask, we just have a minute or two left. Nicole, let's start with you. And Erica, I'll let you in. If you just had one quick tip to share with our listeners, both young and old, about how to be smarter with information on the web, what would you say, Nicole?
I would say be vigilant and be proactive. We can't be passive consumers anymore. And we really have to kind of steer our own ship in terms of the information that we take in and share.
Right. What about you, Erica?
I think it's the one that we found that was effective on Facebook, because no matter what age group we're talking to, if we say think before you share, a light bulb seems to go on.
Well, and also, should it also be read before you share? Because I think a lot of times people share things they haven't even read.
Absolutely. The pause, right? That pause.
Right. So taking a pause, reading something before you sharing it, think about something before you share it, also then research the sources of everything as well, right? So kind of going back through, doing a little investigation, Nicole said, applying a little bit more of critical thinking skills before we're sharing this information.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being with me. That's Erica Hobbs. She's the News Communications Director for the News Literacy Project. She's also the Chicago Program Manager. They work mostly with, as they said, middle school and high schoolers. I want to thank Nicole Cook for joining us as well. She's an assistant professor at the University of Illinois School of Information Science. Ladies, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On Friday, Cook County Democratic leaders endorsed State Senator Kwame Raoul of Chicago for the party's nomination for Attorney General, not former Governor Pat Quinn, who was also seeking the post. On Saturday, Illinois lawmakers appointed a former federal prosecutor as the state's top watchdog in wake of the sexual harassment scandal that continues to shake the state house. It's Monday, and we're talking state politics here on the 21st, catching you up on this weekend's news and looking ahead as lawmakers are headed back to Springfield as the veto session continues. Joining me on the line from the Capitol are Chicago Tribune State House Bureau reporter Monique Garcia and Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey. Monique, Brian, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Hello, Nyla.
Morning, guys. Monique, as you have been reporting for the Chicago Tribune, lawmakers appointed a new top legislative watchdog this weekend, former U.S. Attorney Julie Porter. Before we get to her, can you just sort of remind everybody what's been going on with the fact that this position has been open and how that relates to kind of all of the different sexual harassment allegations and discussions that are happening in the state house right now?
Sure. Well, this really came to light after an advocate in the Capitol publicly accused a sitting state senator of sexual harassment. And she had said at the time that she took this complaint to the Senate president's office, but didn't really hear anything else about it. And what we come to find out is that the Senate president's office said they referred this case to the legislative inspector general. The problem being that that office has been vacant for 3 years. So there really hasn't been any investigation into this as far as we know. And people are feeling that as this problem has brewed, that they really haven't had a place to go with these complaints.
Right. Brian, why did it take so long to fill this position? As Monique said, it's been up until this weekend, it had been left vacant for quite some time.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, this is a pretty sensitive position, and lawmakers don't like the idea of themselves and their staff being investigated. So they want, you know, from their perspective, they want to find somebody who, you know, looks good and will do this, you know, from a public perception standpoint, but maybe not somebody who is going to be, you know, a relentless wanting to make a name for themselves by getting as many lawmakers in trouble as they possibly can. So from their standpoint, it's a problem of perception and self-preservation. And the commission, the ethics group of lawmakers, there's eight of them. They're evenly split between the parties. So it's not like you can say, well, it's one side or the other that bears more responsibility here. Each has their own favorites that they've put up. And, you know, just kind of inertia seems to have taken over. And here we are 3 years later. And it's not just, you know, we know of one case, as Monique said, that came out last week that has to do with sexual harassment. But there are, I've seen reports, 26, 27 cases total that have piled up. Most of those are probably not about sexual harassment. They could be about staff.
All,
we don't even know that they're about lawmakers.
They're all ethics investigations, right? Brian, can I just ask, that commission, you said it was split along bipartisan lines equally. Was it also split equally along gender lines? Is it an equal amount of men and women in that group?
No, until last week, it had been 6 men and 2 women, I think, Monique.
Correct.
And now there's a state senator who is not seeking reelection as a man, has stepped down from that position, and a woman was appointed to succeed him. So now it's 5 men and 3 women.
But I'd like to make a point, though, about the partisan divide. So, yes, it is split equally, but that hasn't stopped the political accusations from flying here. Republicans have really tried to put the blame on House Speaker Michael Madigan. They've said they suggested names, but they didn't go anywhere. They've also noted that that office has sat empty ever since a report was put together by the last IG regarding the Metro scandal that offered some insights into patronage hires that were linked to the speaker. So Republicans have said that you know, we don't think this is an accident. Democrats, though, have said, hey, we've tried to hire people. It's not really a thrilling job. A high-priced lawyer can probably do much better in the private sector. They're not really looking to fill this spot that is largely, for the most part, has been part-time. So there's a lot of blame going back and forth.
Monique, Julie Porter was appointed as a legislative inspector general on Saturday. It was a private meeting in the afternoon on a Saturday. I guess you can't get more quiet than that, Monique, in terms of figuring out how to fill this position and do it quietly.
Right. So this is a legislative panel that operates largely in secret. And they say they do that to, you know, protect people who are being investigated should they not actually be found out. But, you know, it raises a lot of questions about what's happening in these meetings. So this particular emergency meeting took place at 5:30 on Saturday. It was done via a conference call of members. And this was after our understanding is that legislative leaders had met and kind of agreed on a name and greenlighted Julie Porter. So they did pick her. She's very well regarded in the legal community. She's, as you said, a former assistant U.S. attorney in Chicago. And she was known for working on a bunch of high-profile cases. That includes the Conrad Black fraud trial, but also several public corruption cases, including those that led to the conviction of Springfield power broker Bill Cellini and former Governor Rod Blagojevich.
So she certainly got a background in handling corruption, which is generally, unfortunately, I was going to say, sort of what occupies an inspector general, no matter where they are in Illinois. Can I ask Monique what else is going on regarding all of this talk and discussion about sexual harassment in the Capitol and the State House? I understand House Republican Leader Durkin was also talking about perhaps creating a hotline. Is that, would that be required by, I imagine there, does that need to be a law to create that?
That is a piece of legislation that he plans to introduce this week, if it hasn't already been introduced this morning. And so this would set up a toll-free number that'd be run by the Illinois Department of Human Rights. So people can report sexual harassment, but more importantly, so they can be connected to counseling service and kind of given advice on where they should bring their complaint. There's a lot of confusion in the State House, but even among the private sector, of if something happens to you, where do you go? How do you report this? I've talked to folks in the Attorney General's office who note that sexual harassment, you know, it isn't a crime, but it is an issue about equality in the workplace. And so there's kind of a gray, murky area that people are really trying to navigate when it comes to this.
And so this hotline would be specifically for people who had complaints about sexual harassment involving the Capitol, whether that's lobbyists or staff or lawmakers or anything like that?
It would be for folks who work in state government, but also would be open to people in the private sector. The idea is to really connect people with services that they need and to try to make this a conversation that's not just happening in the Capitol, but that's happening in workplaces across the state and across the nation.
And that's
one of the issues, I think, is that people are so isolated. And, you know, if you work for a small business, maybe, there's only 10 employees or something like that, you know all your coworkers very well. It's not like you have a human resources department where you can feel like you could complain anonymously. Maybe there's only one boss at your business, and that's the person who's targeting you. So this is just a way to try and help people who maybe feel a little more isolated, don't know where to turn.
Right. Brian, let's switch gears. And I wonder, you've been reporting on the attorney general's race. Again, a very crowded Democratic field, just like the gubernatorial race. Are we up to 8 candidates? Is that correct for different Democratic candidates for attorney general?
Well, I hasten to confirm that, because you never know what could happen while we're recording.
Perhaps someone else has popped
the show
it
today,
out, right?
But so yeah. Far, yes, yes. Yeah, I think that's right.
And then on Friday, we saw Cook County Democrats endorsing State Senator Kwame Raoul for the party's nomination. And I imagine how much of that dashes former Governor Pat Quinn's hopes of running.
Yeah, so it was a bit of a surprise, I think. I don't know, maybe Monique feels differently, but to me at least, that when Governor Quinn surfaced his name as somebody who might want this job, it's kind of a step back. He had been the governor, and as he pointed out, when one of the people on the Cook County Democratic Committee thanked Mr. Quinn, he turned and said, that's Governor Quinn. So, I mean, he is very proud. Somebody tweeted a photo of a business card of his where he, you know, purportedly his business card that identifies him as, you know, former governor of Illinois in the years when he was in office. But he came and made his pitch to the Democratic Party in Cook County, and they went with State Senator Kwame Raoul, who is a talented fundraiser. He's a well-known politician. He's been active in criminal justice matters. He holds the seat that was once occupied by a former state senator, Barack Obama. So, I mean, he has a lot of institutional support behind him now. But as you pointed out, with so many people who have said they're seeking this office, and we should say that the filing period has not come yet, so that number could shake itself out. People could weed themselves out when you actually have to turn in the signatures. But based on the current field, it could become anyone's game, right? Pat Quinn has significant name recognition that could work for him. It could also work against him because there are some people with hard feelings about him still, particularly in the labor union side of things, where he, at least for among state workers, because of the pension legislation he signed. But I'm going on and on here. But let's just say that it is still going to be a competitive race, because this is looked at as a plum stepping stone type job in Democratic politics.
Monique, how much does the endorsement of the Cook County Democrats matter in this?
Well, I think it, you know, provides money and it helps provide foot soldiers, but this is a race that's statewide. It goes beyond Cook County. And for some folks downstate, having the backing of Chicago Democrats isn't necessarily a good thing. So this is really about proving yourself on a statewide stage, which is, I think, why it did appeal to Pat Quinn so much. He does have name recognition. He's run for almost every major state office that you possibly could. And he's really, I think, trying to capitalize on the unpopularity of Bruce Rauner. I talked to some of his close advisors who think that, you know, Pat Quinn thinks he got a raw deal and hopes that people have buyer's remorse, and he's hoping that maybe they'll give him another chance.
It was actually a pretty close election, I think people probably forget that now, but it was actually pretty close in terms of how the vote came down between Pat Quinn and Bruce Rauner. Brian, I know you've been paying attention to Senator Dick Durbin was tweeting out about Pat Quinn's appetite for public service is, quote, insatiable, and he loves public life and he loves service. So, Monique, I imagine regardless, Pat Quinn is still running for attorney general, regardless of what the Cook County Democrats endorse, right?
I mean, he's indicated that, but, you know, until everything's official, it's not really official. You know, there is a question about money in this race and having that kind of support. Pat Quinn is known to be frugal, and it's hard to run statewide unless you have a lot of money and you have a lot of support. So I think we'll know more here in the next couple weeks and next couple months.
Right. The field for Republicans, a lot smaller. Erica Harold in that field. Let's just turn. We just have a couple minutes left, but I just wanted to ask you guys about any important bills you guys are keeping your eye on upcoming during this second half of the veto session. Brian, let's start with you.
Well, there's going to be, I think the Democrats in the House are going to try again to override Governor Rauner's veto of a measure that would prohibit prohibit local governments from making so-called right-to-work zones, which would basically is a way to undercut the power of labor unions and theoretically, in Governor Rauner's hypothesis, you know, lure factories to local, you know, if a county or a city wanted to make themselves sort of an economic empowerment zone, I think is what the governor calls it, then they could, you know, come in and have weaker union rules in that jurisdiction. This is something that obviously labor unions hate, this idea, and have worked with Democrats to try and thwart the governor. So far, I think only one community in Illinois has actually tried this. But the Democrats have pushed legislation that would ban this practice completely in the state. And they failed to override the governor's veto. A couple of Republicans voted present. And so the unions are working very hard on one side to try and get those Republicans to at least one of them to come on board and work with Democrats. On the other hand, the governor and House Republican leader Jim Durkin have made this a or if not the top priority for veto session to prevent this veto from being overridden. This is an issue that's very dear to the governor's, not only to his agenda, but also to his heart.
Yeah, Monique, we've got just a minute left. Just one thing you're keeping an eye on, the most important thing you're keeping an eye on for veto session?
Well, I'd like to note something that is not going to happen, which we just found out. I talked to the sponsor today, and that's a ban on bump stocks. These are these devices that you can put onto guns to increase the rate of speed. They were used, of course, in the mass shooting in Las Vegas, and so there's been a lot of debate about how to control these and what kind of gun restriction measures should be pushed in the state. It's a very divisive issue. It falls not just along partisan lines, but along regional lines, where folks in Chicago favor more gun control. Folks downstate, where there's a big hunting community, don't like these kind of restrictions. The sponsor says he's going to wait until January, when the vote threshold is lower, to try again.
That's the Chicago Tribune's Monique Garcia. I want to thank Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey for joining us. Thanks for being with me, guys. Before we end today, just an update on a story we were talking about last week. We spoke with the Illinois Farm Bureau and a few farmers who requested a harvest emergency declaration from the governor. That did happen this weekend. That's in effect for the next 43 days. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a great day.